Hey, hi, hello, my creepy lovelies. Welcome back to another episode here at the Creepy Cryptid Crypt. I am your host, Black Widow, and I'm joined today by your favorite friend, Dr. Manhattan.
Favorite friend? It's quite the honor. I didn't know.
Could be.
That I was their favorite.
I'm assuming.
I'm not surprised. I just didn't know.
Yeah. Today we have a serial killer for you out of the 70s and the 80s. And this individual was known, or still is known, as the Scorecard Killer. And sometimes he is also known as the Southern California Strangler. Dun dun dun. This is one of those ones where I like look up because the assigned media name sounds interesting. And then as I do the notes and I read, I'm like, oh, okay. This was not fun.
No, definitely not any fun. I don't want to give credit to a person that has killed, but Scorecard Killer is probably one of the most cleverish sounding names. Not that they named themselves, I suppose, either.
I think the media gave him that name.
Well, but from what I saw, I think it was the police after what they found. But I also think that Scorecard's a bit misleading, but we'll get into it.
That's fair. That's a fair assessment. So, this one is gnarly, trigger warning for all the things. So, you've been warned. Good luck. Randy Stevencraft was born March 19th, 1945 in Long Beach, California, and was the fourth and youngest child in his family. He is also the only son. So he is the youngest of four, and he's got three sisters. So, already chaos. His family was originally from Wyoming, but they relocated to California shortly after he was born. And then sometime in 1948, they moved to Westminster, California, where they remained for most of his life. He ended up graduating from high school in 1963 and attended Claremont Men's College in Claremont, California. And while at Claremont College, he joined ROTC. And during the 60s, he demonstrated his support of the Vietnam War enthusiastically for the presidential candidate Barry Goldwater. Excuse me, which I thought was an interesting tidbit, but somebody thought it was important to put in their article, so I thought it was important to put here. While at school, because I think Claremont College is just generally a very small college, and I think back then it was even smaller, probably. But while he was in college, it was rumored that he had a fondness for bondage, and his roommates reported that he would disappear pretty regularly, like 2 to 3 times a week for at least 72 hours, and then reappear at weird hours, and then just, like, hang out in his room.
Yeah, so there's reports, at least, that he got into some weird shit at a young age. But growing up in a conservative home, who really knows if that was paid attention to or monitored, being the youngest of that many, especially the only boy. So I kind of got, like, Dahmer vibes in the sense that it almost seemed like there wasn't really the right guidance around him to get into that shit.
Probably.
Which certainly didn't help.
Yeah.
Later in life.
Not at all. In 1966, he was arrested for lewd conduct after propositioning, an undercover police officer in Huntington Beach. It happened again to him in 1967, but that time he got off with a warning. And like most kids in college, he got super into alcohol and apparently poker games. So the combination of the two were reported to keep him from graduating on time. So he did repeat a class and ended up graduating a year later. And then after he graduated, he began working as a bartender at a gay bar and was known for heavily using Valium to ward off stomach pain and headaches. Yeah. This note's out of place. He ended up graduating with his bachelor's in economics and his political allegiances. I tried to combine alliances and allegiances, and it just was a mess. Shifted, and he worked to support Robert Kennedy at that point. After getting his bachelor's degree, it was reported that he got bored of the bar scene, and so he joined the U.S. Air Force, and he had high marks on all skills on the skills test. And because of that, and because he was performing super well, he was given high security clearances, and they would post him at Edwards Air Force Base. In 1969, he came out and told his parents he was gay. He ended up being dishonorably discharged. Sorry, discharged. I don't know if it was honorably or dishonorably.
Some say based on medical grounds.
Who knows
what that means. It's interesting though that, you know, he's got a double life going, right? Where,
mm-hmm.
I mean, who knows if economics is really what he wanted.
Mm.
I like to think that maybe some of that was just family influence because he's like trying to live this
double life.
You know.
No.
Life, and obviously it's not really what he wants.
No. So discharged from the Air Force, like Dr. Manhattan said, on medical grounds. So he goes back to bartending.
His true love.
And his roommates, you know, continue to report that he has erratic behavior. Again, you know, leaving for long periods of time and then coming back and locking himself in his room. One other roommate reported that he was really specific about things. So, like, he liked to keep things neat in the apartment. And if you fucked with it, he got real volatile real quickly.
I do think we should just take a moment to say that it's okay to want things neat.
Yeah.
It does not mean you're a psychopath or a killer. But
yes.
Maybe don't lose your shit over it if someone else isn't neat.
So we've already got interesting sexual tastes, anger issues, and a lot of other things that we don't really know about where he's going, what he's participating in. So we've got a volatile situation.
In a volatile time. I mean,
yeah.
Stegger up, you know, just during, obviously, all the civil rights stuff and apparently, you know, changing his support to a guy like Kennedy who then gets assassinated. That really bothered him. Like,
mm-hmm.
a lot of stuff went down during this man's life.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Okay, so I was taking a moment to digest what Dr. Manhattan said, but also read this note about his first victim. His first known victim has some similarities to the victim that got away from Dahmer and resulted in Dahmer being arrested.
The one that got away.
So essentially what happened was, is Kraft met this 13-year-old runaway on the beach. His name was Joseph. He said, hey, I've got booze and I've got pills. Do you want a party? And the young man was like, yeah, that sounds okay. I like booze. And when they got back to the apartment, Kraft was like, look, here are photos of me having sex with other dudes. Some of them are passed out. Some of them are maybe dead. A lot of them are naked. And then he drugged the alcohol, or he mixed the pills in a smart combo, because then the young man was half conscious, stripped naked, and sodomized. And then when Kraft went to work, thankfully the young man was able to escape the apartment, but he was still under the influence of whatever Kraft had given him, so it took him a while, but he finally got to a nearby bar where the patrons called an ambulance and doctors pumped his stomach at the emergency room. And then once he was, you know, more lucid, he led police back to Kraft's place. And so similar to what you see in the Dahmer documentary, the cops go to Kraft's place. They find, you know, a bunch of drugs, a bunch of photos of Kraft having sex with a bunch of different dudes, but they did the search without a warrant. And they didn't see anything concerning enough, so they couldn't make an arrest. They had nothing, because they just went in there with no warrant, blah, blah, blah. So he was not arrested at this point in time. So now we're in 1971, and Kraft finds work at a bottled water plant in Huntington Beach. He is still cruising bars at night. And at one point, he enrolled in Long Beach State University. At that time, he was like, oh, maybe I'll, like, get a teaching credential. But again, the party scene called to him more than his education. And at this time, he meets this guy, Jeff Graves. Although, that makes no sense. I need to stop doing my text notes. He meets this guy, Jeff Graves. Some people were like, oh, they're just friends and roommates. A lot of other people are like, no, no, they're lovers. They're a couple. But even though he was coupled up with this Jeff dude, he was like still cruising bars and like picking dudes up. So I don't know if they had like an open thing or if Jeff just didn't care or what. So, and then October 5th, 1971, police find a man's nude decomposing body on the Ortega Highway in southern Orange County. They were able to identify the body as Wayne Joseph Duquette, a 30-year-old bartender from Long Beach who had been missing for 2 weeks. Coroner gave an estimated date of death around September 20th, but they couldn't find any obvious signs of foul play, and they never found any of his personal belongings. So, he is reported as being Kraft's first murder victim. But I do want to remind us all that there were a ton of serial killers in Southern California during this time. So, we know. Police forces are already overstretched, overwhelmed. It's a clusterfuck. There's, you know, if we look at our map here, the big-ass fucking red dot. Mayhem. That's 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6, 7, 8, 9. That's 9 serial killers all operating at the same time frame, or at least having 1 to 2 years of overlap in Southern California.
I wish, in a weird way, that we knew whether or not there was any communication between these killers. Or if it was just, like, somehow they just knew because of the day and age that, like, they could dump these bodies in such common, similar, same-as-the areas, you know what I mean? Because you've got so many different guys that operate around the same time in the same area that it made it impossible for police in a way to really hone in on them faster. It's just kind of remarkable.
Yeah. Sorry, I'm just looking at the map and like Tennessee and South Carolina are empty and I don't feel like that's accurate.
Who knows? I can't imagine any state's truly free of.
Yeah, that's true. So we've got chaos in Southern California. And it's just a mess. So the rest of 1971 and most of 1972 is pretty quiet. The next confirmed victim is in December of 1972, the day after Christmas. They find Edward Daniel Moore, a 20-year-old Marine, beside the freeway, the 405 freeway in Seal Beach. He was last seen alive at the Camp Pendleton Barracks on Christmas Eve, and somebody had reported to see him being dumped from a moving vehicle at 1:45 a.m. the day after Christmas. Because he was dumped from a moving vehicle, his body sustained a great bit of damage. But when the coroner did come upon the scene, it had appeared that he was strangled, bludgeoned, and there were bite marks on his genitals, and one of his socks was jammed in his own rectum. So, at this point in time, we're just kind of gonna ping pong into a variety of similar murders. So if that, what I just read to you, was disturbing and you don't want to listen, you should turn us off right now, because it's only going to get worse. So. Okay. 6 weeks later, in February of 1973, police find a John Doe beside the Terminal Island Freeway in the Wilmington District of L.A. Forensics determined that he had been strangled a day or two before he was found. He was roughly 18 years old, and he also had a sock stuffed into his rectum. Then Easter Sunday in April, they find another John Doe in Huntington Beach. He had all of his clothes on except for his shoes and socks. And underneath the clothing, his genitals were missing. He had ligature marks and some scarring on his wrists. And the coroner had a difficult time picking a cause of death because it was either between asphyxiation by strangulation or blood loss, but they couldn't really tell what came first. So, Shortly after that discovery, police found another John Doe who had been dismembered and was scattered across two different counties. They ended up finding the head in Long Beach, the torso, right leg, and both arms were found in San Pedro, and the left leg was found at Sunset Beach. There were clear markings on the body parts that John Doe had been restrained, and they could tell that the remains were refrigerated before they were dumped, and they never found this victim's hands. Sorry, I have to take a drink now. This is very stressful. Okay. So now, July 28th, 1973. 32-year-old Ron, my notes say weed, but that might be wrong, from Fullerton, vanished while bar hopping. They found him July 30th with all of his clothes on, aside from his shoes and his socks. His remains were also found next to the 405 freeway in Seal Beach, and he had been beaten and strangled. They were also able to tell that he had been bound and hung upside down before he was murdered. I don't know a lot about forensics, but I'm curious how they were able to tell that. His body also sustained torture via biting on his stomach and his genitalia, and then again one of the socks was found in his rectum. So we've got very violent, very sexual crimes that are being dumped in a wide variety of places.
At high speeds, mind you.
Yeah. So. And I guess, like, part of my brain when I was writing these notes was like, why don't they have a car, a make, or a model yet? But also, like, if you're seeing a body getting dumped from a moving car, like, the first thing you're going to pay attention to is where it went. You're going to pay less attention to the cars.
I mean, maybe. Maybe not.
That's just where my brain would go.
I think that's hard to speculate. That would be a wild thing to actually see take place.
Yeah, there's that. I don't know. It's a weird time. Okay, and then December 29th, 23-year-old Vincent Cruz was pulled from a ravine in San Bernardino. He was fully clothed but barefoot, so you could guess where one of his socks was found. What was interesting is that his face had been freshly shaved, but his hands were missing, and in place of his hands, there were plastic bags. And this piece of information is horrifying, so I apologize for our male listeners. A pencil-sized object that was never identified was shoved into his penis before he died.
A couple quick things here just to throw out there.
Okay.
Kraft apparently said that he was kicked out of the military because he came out as gay. A number of the victims that they connected to him were in some way connected to the military.
A good chunk of them were Marines, yeah.
Interesting, like, aspect there of, like, him almost, like, wanting revenge maybe on this, like, version of life he didn't get or something, perhaps? Mm. Or that didn't go his way, yeah?
Maybe. I do know one of his roommates said that, like, he had openly said he had a thing for Marines, specifically.
Mm-hmm.
Which is why he would visit the Marine bases so often. But I also wonder, like, if you've been discharged from any branch of the military, like, are you technically allowed to be on any of those properties?
I don't really know, but my understanding is that in some cases you can be on a military base with an active member of the military, but they have to essentially vouch for you. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that that applies, like, everywhere. You can't just take a person to any base, but...
Well, yeah, because some bases have way higher security clearances than others. Yeah. Okay.
Yeah, we can leave it at this. His work and even tools from the bartending life were used in many of the killings. And the torture involved.
Yes.
Weirdly creative psycho man.
Yeah. So then he kind of goes quiet for about 6 months, and then June 1st, 42-year-old Malcolm Eugene was found nude, propped up against a mesquite tree next to Highway 86, which apparently is west of the Salton Sea in Imperial County. This guy had been an unemployed truck driver who came to California from Alabama to look for some work. His genitals had been severed, and a mesquite branch was shoved into his rectum. 3 weeks later, Roger Dickerson, age 18, who was bar hopping in San Clemente, went inside to tell his friends that he got a ride to LA for the weekend, and he didn't tell them anything else. Unfortunately, the driver sodomized, strangled him, and left bite marks on his genitalia and his left nipple before dumping his nude body near the Laguna Beach golf course. August 1974, Thomas Paxton Lee, age 25, was found in an oil field in Long Beach, strangled but fully clothed. August 12th, 23-year-old Gary Wayne Cordova was found fully clothed but barefoot next to a highway in southern Orange County. Yep, read that right. His death was originally ruled as an overdose of alcohol and Valium because he had no other signs of being connected to the other body, so he wasn't originally connected to the murders, I think, until after Kraft was arrested. And then November 29th, 1974, 19-year-old James Dale Reeves was found in a bloody t-shirt with a large tree limb in his anus. And a lot of reports put the size of that tree limb. If you're curious, don't be. It's very large and wide, and it just fucking horrific. Okay, so what's interesting is this next murder, they're fairly confident that two people were involved. And we'll get to that later in the story, but they also think that at some point a second killer did join him. So that kind of goes to your theory of, did they talk together? Did they hang out? Did they work together?
I'll wait to say anything else because I don't know where you're going and don't want to spoiler both the wrong avenue. But
Dime just wanted to put...
The police had a very specific person in mind that they thought he was working with.
Okay, well, I think we'd touch on that further down. This one's very long. There's a lot of pages. So, December 20th of 1974, 17-year-old John Lewis went missing from the Long Beach skating rink. He had just gotten skates for Christmas, and he was super excited to go try them out. People walking on the beach found him floating in the ocean just off of Sunset Beach with a wooden surveyor stake rammed into his rectum. Forensics showed that he had been strangled while bound. He had alcohol in his system, and they think two people were involved in this one because they found two sets of footprints in the sand where he was carried to the water from the parking lot. And then January 17th, 1975, construction workers found Craig Victors, who had been strangled to death near a Long Beach motel on the Pacific Coast Highway. He was barefoot, fully clothed, but wearing two pairs of pants. So now we've got a ton of victims in different counties, and the timeline is accelerating in between each kill. So thankfully at this point a task force is formed and they're starting to get people from several different jurisdictions, and it looks like it was officially assembled on January 24th, 1975. And they had law enforcement from Orange County, Imperial County, San Bernardino County, as well as LA PD, Long Beach PD, Seal Beach, Irvine, and Huntington Beach. They got a lot of people on the task force.
Took 4 years.
And well, okay, so it's 1975. Let me get up and look at the map. 1975. Okay, well, that makes sense, though. Because they're right in between the Skid Row Slasher, Rodney Alcala, the Hillside Stranglers, the Freeway Killer, and Chester Turner. So they've got... Wait, no. Not Chester Turner? What month is this? What year is this? Nope, too early for Chester Turner. So they've got at least... 1, 2, 3, 4, 5... 5 to 6 active serial killers happening all at one time. So they're like, we need task force at this point. No, shit's getting out of hand.
It's kind of a miracle they didn't run out of, like, people to be going after this.
Well, so in addition to that, they were given information from an FBI profiler at Quantico and special assistance from the special investigator from the California State Attorney General's office and some very qualified forensic pathologists and psychologists.
Different departments working together.
Yeah, right.
Those are the days.
They also had Dr. E. Manziel Patterson from UC Irvine profiling the scorecard killer. And he said that this individual was somebody who had a desire to be masculine but does not feel masculine and therefore bites on the genitals of his prey to symbolically make them female. Which I thought was an interesting way to discern that.
Well, yeah, because pardon the language, but how the fuck would you even be able to figure out why a person would do that anyway?
Well, you can make an assumption.
These are wild things.
But he could just be doing it because he likes to.
I also think this is an odd case because we don't seem to really have all that much on his younger life.
Mm.
And there's certainly got to be so much that happened
early
in his life that in some way influenced this guy.
Yeah.
So.
I don't know. So, task force is assembled. They're talking to each other to trying to figure out what the fuck is going on. But the murders continue. I just want to make sure this year is right, because that's a big jump. Yeah, that's not right. Yes.
Well, I was just going to say, this is a case where eventually there are a specific number that they accuse him of, but there's certainly a higher number that he could possibly still be responsible for, which I find interesting because the ones that are named even as potential victims, when you look at the timeline, it's kind of weird because it's like it's almost like he's only killing like 5 or 6 guys a year, which I'm sure it was way more than that.
Yeah.
But
yeah. So, well, again, like, I mean, this is definitely a very specific MO, but if you're another serial killer working at the same time and you don't have time to get rid of a body the way that you'd like to, you might want to mimic another active serial killer so it gets added to his body count, not yours. But they're also pompous anyway. Like, I don't even know if that's really feasible.
I think some of it was just like the day and age, though. I mean, it was a time when that was about as easy a way to get rid of something as you could, was just like dump off side of the road, like.
Yeah. Okay, so March 29th, Kevin David Cockrell, a 19-year-old, was hitchhiking. He got a ride and disappeared. May 9th, 3 small children looking for starfish on the beach found his severed head on the Long Beach Marina.
Not a starfish.
Nope.
Not a starfish.
And apparently people saw the vehicle that Kevin got in for the ride, so they went looking for the vehicle. They gave the description of a black and white Mustang, and they found it a few days later and got the license plate. Gave the license plate to the cops. Cops traced it. Registration was belonged to Randy Kraft. They questioned him on May 19th. Kraft said, oh yeah, I gave Kevin a ride, but he was alive when I left him. I left him at this all-night cafe. And, you know, the detectives, rightfully so, wanted to charge him with murder at that point, but the prosecutor's office was like, we don't have enough to do that. So, they didn't. At this point in time, Kraft is now employed part-time as a computer operator for a flight company at the Long Beach Airport, and his medical issues, such as chronic migraines and stomach pains, get worse, which then led to insomnia. And the doctor also said that he was hypoglycemic at this point. So he's got a lot of medical issues. And I think it was pointed out because with all of these different medical issues, you can be prescribed different drugs. And some of those drugs popped up in his victims. So, June 1975, Kraft is arrested again, but for misdemeanor lewd behavior in Cherry Park. after that, his work was like, we don't want you anymore, and they fired him. But the computer experience got him a job with a consulting firm, which is going to turn out to be a problem. So, but with all that change happening, murder slowed down for a bit, at least until October. Larry Jean Walters, 21, was killed. Wait. Oh, two separate notes. The period is in the wrong place. Halloween, Larry Jean Walters, 21-year-old, was killed in L.A. County. On New Year's Eve, 22-year-old Mark Hall disappeared from a party in San Juan Capistrano. An off-duty police officer found his body on January 3rd in Cleveland National Forest, which is near Riverside County. His body was found nude, tied to a small tree. Forensics stated that he had been sodomized and then tortured to death, and his legs had been pretty badly slashed with a knife. His face, chest, genitals had been burned with a cigarette lighter, and a cocktail swizzle stick was jammed into his penis.
There's those tools.
Yep. It was shoved in there so hard that it ruptured his bladder, and, like, it went into his bladder. Yeah. His genitals had been severed and then shoved in his rectum along with dirt and leaves. His blood alcohol limit was 7 times the legal limit, which was probably fatal in itself, but the killer also shoved leaves and dirt down his throat for a good measure. So, at this point, you know, Kraft is still in a relationship with this Jeff guy, but it kind of starts to get bad because Jeff's like, dude, you keep getting in trouble for lewd behavior. Like, the fuck? So they break up. But Kraft finds another Jeff, much younger, 19 years old. They move in together in early 1976. And actually, at this point, the bodies are now being found stuffed into trash bags, which results in them being discovered later because they're not being torn open until they're in the dumps or at the compactors or at the trash facility. So they got at least 9.
Wow, fun fact. An active serial killer during this time was the trash bag killer.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So this is where it gets kind of messy. So they were able to recover 13-year-old Oliver Peter Molitor, found in Manhattan Beach on March 21st, 1976. April 7th, they recovered 17-year-old Kenneth Eugene Buchanan, who was found in Inglewood. April 19th, Larry Mendez, age 14, was found in L.A. June 11th, 13-year-old Michael Craig McGee was found in Redondo Beach. In October, Randall Lawrence Moore, 16 years old, was found in a trash bag next to Highway 80, east of El Cajon. December 10th, Paul Fuchs, age 19, went missing from Redondo Beach and was never seen again. Many other victims were dumped at the Borrego Hot Springs near the Calexico on the Mexican border. So, like you said, we're at the end of 1976 and the start of 1977. And the police were absolutely consumed with the surrender of Patrick Kearney because he was the actual trash bag killer. And he had at least 28 bodies. So now they're trying to discern those names that I just listed. Did they belong to Kearney or Kraft? Because, yes.
Well, it's a random side question, but who had the longest run as a serial killer?
I'd have to Google that.
Because, I mean, this is like a 7-year run at this point for Mr. Kraft. That's kind of insane.
Yeah, but I think one of the freeway killers was active for like 15 years.
Yeah.
And it's hard because a lot of the serial killers from like the 1700s and the 1800s went on for 20 plus years. So, we can Google it after.
Now, if there was ever a vampire killer, would have taken the cake because they could be active for
200 years.
Hundreds, if not thousands of years.
I was like, there's like 6 vampire killers. What are you talking about? But not like actual vampires. They just think they're vampires. Okay. Oh, difference was, Kearney's victims were typically shot through the head. And when he was in San Quentin, obviously the murders continued. So they're like, okay, we still have a problem. We're on page 6 of 10. We're getting there, guys. April 16th, 1978, Scott Michael Hughes, 19-year-old Marine from Camp Pendleton, was found on the side of Highway 91 in Orange. He was fully dressed, but his laces were missing from his shoes and his pants were stained with blood. During the autopsy, they discovered that his genitals had been mutilated, and his left testicle had been removed. He had Valium in his blood, but ultimately his death was ruled as ligature strangulation, which means that he was bound. Ligature strangulation is bound. Sorry, manual strangulation is hands. I got confused for a second. June 10th, Roland Young, age 23, had just been released from Orange County Jail for public intoxication, which he seemed to be arrested for a lot. He was released from jail at 8:19 p.m. and was next seen at 3:30 a.m. dead in an Irvine gutter. He had alcohol and Valium in his system. His wrists were still bound, and his scrotum had been severed, so it was part of his penis. He was stabbed 4 times in the chest and then redressed. Sorry, we have another Camp Pendleton victim. My brain froze. We've already got... Maybe they're just thinking because the span of time is, like, spread out enough, like, it's not a problem.
Well, I think in retrospect, it's easier to see connections, whereas at the time...
Yeah, that's
true.
It's
probably a lot harder for them to piece it together.
Mm. So... June 19th, 23-year-old Richard Keith was hitchhiking from Camp Pendleton to L.A. to see his girlfriend. Along the way, he called her and they got into a fight, so he started to hitchhike back. An off-duty fireman found his body the next morning in southern Orange County. At this point, police think that he most... So it's interesting. So you've got some victims who are being pushed out of cars, you've got other victims who are being put in trash bags, and you have other victims who are just being left places. So I could see why they had a hard time kind of putting it all together,
mm-hmm.
because there's varying styles here. July 6, 1978, Keith Bell was still alive when a motorist found him on the northbound lane of I-5 in Mission Viejo. Paramedics arrived on the scene at 3:30 a.m., but they were unable to save him from the overdose of alcohol and Tylenol. During the autopsy, they found ligature marks and burns from a cigarette lighter. November 18th, 1978, Michael Joseph something. That can't be the last name. 21-year-old Long Beach truck driver had been brutalized, sodomized, and his eyelids were seared with a cigarette lighter from a vehicle. His remains were dumped 20 feet from where they found Edward Moore in December 1972. So he's going back. May 29th, 1979, 13-year-old Thomas Ludgreen had been picked up from Reseda at 11 a.m. and dumped in a Gura at 1:30 p.m. He had been strangled and stabbed repeatedly. His throat was slashed and his genitals were severed. June 16th, 1979, a lot of witnesses saw Donald Harold Crisil pushed out of a slow-moving vehicle on the 405 freeway in Irvine. Many of the witnesses couldn't give, like, a solid vehicle description. One guy was like, it was a car. Another guy was like, it was a van. Like, they were arguing over the model of the vehicle. The body was still warm when police arrived, so they're closing in. Excuse me. He also had ligature marks on his neck and wrists, and he died from an overdose of booze and painkillers. August 5th, 1979, Marcus Krabs, age 17, who had been hitchhiking out of Newport Beach on the Pacific Highway, was found sodomized, stabbed, and strangled next to the Ventura Freeway near the LA County line. 15-year-old Donald Hayden was last seen alive in Hollywood at 1 a.m. on August 27, 1979. Construction workers found him at Liberty Canyon, left in a dumpster at a new housing project. His body had been sodomized and strangled. 17-year-old David Murillo disappeared while hitchhiking along Highway 101 in September. On September 11th, his nude body was found on the side of the same highway. He had also been bludgeoned, strangled, and had ligature burns on his ankles, and he was raped. And at this point, people are panicking. Police are overwhelmed. Gay bars are posting warnings. They're like, this is John Doe. This is the description we think we have. Do not ignore this guy. He's dangerous as fuck. So, and I don't know if they had, it didn't seem like they had a good description of what Kraft looked like. So I don't know if the posters helped. Okay. From 1978 and 1979, Kraft held a steady freelancing data processing job as a consultant, and he was still living with he was 19-year-old when he met the other Jeff, second Jeff, and they were traveling a lot for this job. And a lot of people who knew them said that they both kept weird hours. Apparently, Jeff was a bakery owner, worked at a bakery.
Jeff the baker?
Yeah. Sorry, this doesn't make any sense, the second note. And he was also, like, he knew about Kraft's, like, weird behavior and stuff and, like, didn't care. What's interesting, though, is that, and this kind of comes back to what you said about that double lifestyle, is Kraft's employers described him as a self-starter, an excellent problem solver, and an exceptional employee. So, and then in June of 1982, Kraft and Jeff went to couples counseling because Kraft didn't like that Jeff tried to dominate the relationship.
Control issues. What a shock.
Mm-hmm. So they were like, okay, we're going to go on this European vacation to like work it out and get better. They never went on the European vacation, but they continued therapy. But it was all over the country and kind of infrequent because Kraft is traveling for this consulting job.
I like how it's almost always a European vacation that causes rifts in the relationship.
Right. Oh, ouch. Yeah. Oh, that was painful. As a result of this travel, the murderers moved out of California. Okay. 17-year-old Michael Sean O'Fallon, a Colorado native, was hitchhiking to British Columbia in June 1980. He made it back to Oregon before he was murdered. His naked body had been found along I-5, 10 miles from Salem, July... Oh, he wasn't found until July. His body was hogtied with shoelaces, a cord around his scrotum, and he had fatal levels of alcohol and Valium in his blood, but they were able to rule the cause of death as strangulation. Robert Wyatt Loggins Jr. was last seen August 22nd, 1980. On September 3rd, 1980, some kids were playing near the El Toro Marina Air Base. That has to be Marine Air Base. Anyway, they found his body in a plastic garbage bag. He also had deadly levels of alcohol and antihistamines in his system. And originally, police thought that the murder was not connected until they seized evidence from Randy Kraft's car and home. In April of 1981, 17-year-old Michael Dwayne Cluck went missing as he was hitchhiking from Seattle to California, and he was picked up in Oregon. He accepted a ride from the killer, and his body was found dumped along I-5 near Goshen. He was violently sodomized, kicked, and beaten to death. His thighs and groin were marked by fingernail scratches. And the same day that his body was found, Kraft visited a nearby hospital for an injured foot, which he said he bruised accidentally while walking into something in his hotel room. July 29th, people in LA reported bad smells off the Hollywood freeway. When police officers investigated, they found the two decomposing bodies from a gully near the highway, 13-year-old Raymond Davis and 16-year-old Robert Avila. August 20th, 1981, Christopher Williams, age 17, was found dead beside the road in the San Bernardino Mountains. He had two different types of sedatives in his body, and his nostrils were stuffed with paper, which forensics deduced that it caused him to suffocate. November 26. Brian, the last name is butchered here, I apologize. Age 26, was found along I-5 near Portland. He had alcohol and Valium in his system, but died of asphyxiation. December 7th, Kraft was in Grand Rapids, Michigan for a computer conference. And this is important because this guy, Dennis, and his cousin, Chris Showborn, two cousins, disappeared that night from the bar at the hotel where Kraft was staying. And their bodies were found together in Plainville Township on December 9th. The autopsy showed that they both had lots of drugs and alcohol in their system, and they had both been strangled. Showborn was found nude. And a ballpoint pen from the hotel was thrust into his bladder from his penis. And he had all of his clothes but his shoes. No shoes. And his slacks were unzipped to show his genitals. And they found the body on December 9th, like I said, and Kraft was already on his way back to Oregon. We're almost done, guys. December 9th, a motorist found that name isn't right. You have it? Lace Trenton tags. Okay, it came out as Laced Trenton tags.
Lance.
I think it's Lance. Yeah, my notes heard Lace.
I mean, he probably was laced or something.
Yeah, he was. Lance Trenton tags, age 19, was found not far from where Brian Witcher was dumped in November. He had drugs, specifically Valium and alcohol, in his system, and he choked to death on his own sock.
Not a good way to go.
No. December 18th, a guy collecting cans outside of Hubbard, Oregon, found Anthony Jose Silvera, age 29, who was last seen December 3rd, hitchhiking home from work. The tox report showed that he also had alcohol in his system, and the autopsy showed that he was strangled and sodomized. Sorry. So now at this point, Oregon police is like, okay, we've got to fucking talk to Southern California PD because we've got victims who have some similarities to their victims. What they did, which was the smartest fucking thing that they finally did, and I don't know if this was Oregon PD's idea or the task force, but they started to run lists of airlines and hotels and car rentals and all of that stuff from Oregon to California, and Kraft's name appeared 18 times on the final list. So they're like, this is the fucking guy. Like, this is the guy. But there's a few more deaths in 1983 before he's arrested. There's 21-year-old Eric Church, who was found sodomized, bludgeoned, and strangled next to the 605 highway on January 28th. The semen from his body ended up matching Kraft's blood types. That was really important when it came to trial. Michael Lane, 24, disappeared hitchhiking through Orange County, but they didn't find his remains until 1984. Jeffrey Nelson, age 18, Roger Duvall Jr., age 20, both disappeared when they were bar hopping on February 11th, and their remains were found together near Claremont College. They had also been drugged, sodomized, and strangled. Okay, so now, the big day, May 14th, 1983, just after 1 a.m., CHP sees this drunk driver, and they're like...
Well, they see somebody that they believe is a drunk driver.
Yes, same. Mm. They're like, all right, we got to stop this guy. So they stop this drunk driver on the San Diego Highway in Mission Viejo, California. Before the officers were fully able to get out of their vehicle and approach the suspect's vehicle, the suspect got out of the car. And while he was getting out of his car, a ton of beer cans fell out. And he also got out to dump the remainder of his beer from the beer bottle on the pavement. His pants were not zipped up, and he was arrested originally for drunk driving. Kraft is 38 years old at this point.
Been doing this for how many years that we know of?
Too many.
Over a decade. He's getting sloppy. It is what it is, right?
Yeah.
At this point, come on.
Yeah. So they're like, okay, this is what we have. We know he's drunk. We're going to arrest him on drunk driving. So they put him in the car. He's in cuffs. Now they approach the vehicle to see if anybody else is in the vehicle. And upon closer inspection, there was a passenger in the vehicle, but the passenger was dead. He was barefoot with his pants unzipped and his genitals exposed, and he had fresh finger marks around his neck. So now they're like, okay, we get to look through the rest of the car, where they found lots of alcohol, 9 different prescription drugs, including Valium and various painkillers, 47 Polaroids of nude men who were either unconscious or dead. And here's where we get to the scorecard part. So they found a briefcase in the trunk, and in the briefcase it had a yellow sheet of paper, you know, like the legal pad guys. Excuse me. 61 comments printed neatly in 2 columns. And they would later decipher those columns as a coded list of murder victims. The victim from the vehicle was identified as 25-year-old Terry Gamboa, a Marine who was stationed at El Toro Marine Base. And the autopsy showed that his blood had high levels of alcohol and Ativan. Ativan was also found on the car. But the cause of death was ligature strangulation. And after a search of the vehicle, they 100% got a warrant to search Kraft's house. And they were able to match the couch in the living room to several of the photos with the nude or conscious or dead men. They also matched the yellow rug in the house to fibers on several of the bodies. And in the garage, they found a rather odd and large collection of mismatched belts, chains, shoelaces, and clothing. And they were actually able to locate one of the jackets in the garage and identify it as belonging to one of the murder victims from Michigan. Detectives were also able to identify 3 more California murder victims from the Polaroids. And Kraft's fingerprints were matched to a shard of broken glass from a 1975 murder scene. So we have all of that. And initially, he's charged with drunk driving and the murder of Terry Gamboa. He's held on $250,000 bail. Later, they charge him with 4 more murders. And a week after, they keep charging him with more murders. The judge revokes his bail at this point and says, no bail for you. Especially since California citizens were already grappling with the capture of trash bag killer Patrick Kearney and the freeway killer, who together were estimated to murder 49 people from 1978 to 1981. So, the scorecard they found, right? 2 neatly printed columns with 30 cryptid items on the left and 30 on the right. So what they ended up figuring out after it gave everybody a fucking headache was that 2-in-1 or 2-in-1 beach or GR2 would refer to double murders. And at the end of it, they only were able to match 45 people to the list with a total tally of 67 murders and 22 that they had never recovered. So what was the final number you were able to find?
Around that.
Yeah. So they started trial in September of 1983. I don't think that date's right. Hang on. Oh, he's creepy.
Well, yeah, I mean, like, unsuspectingly so. Like, I feel like if you just look at a random picture, especially if it's more current, you're not going to be like, yeah, it's a serial killer. But
yeah.
Okay. Then again, what do they fucking look like?
Oh, wow, that's interesting. I didn't find this note before. So during the trial, they interviewed over 700 witnesses and had more than 250 physical exhibits. Formally charged with 15 murders in addition to 2 counts of sodomy and 1 of masculation. Yeah, see, that trial date wasn't right. Trial began September 1988, and I had 1983, which was wrong. Took a long time. Cameras were officially barred from court, which was super smart on the judge's part. And those who testified ranged from highway patrol officers, the guys who pulled him over, forensic pathologists. And they filed murder charges not only in California, but also in Oregon and Michigan. They arrested their case on November 30th, 1988, and the jury deliberated for 11 days. So he was acquitted of the sodomizing of Roger Duval, but convicted on all of the murder charges, plus the additional count of sodomy and mutilation. During the sentencing phase, his lawyer called a psychiatrist to try to say that his violence was something that he had, like, no control over. He just, like, went into these blind fits of rage. But ultimately it didn't work, and the juries recommended the death penalty for him on August 11th, 1989. The judge officially sentenced him to death November 29th, 1989, and noted that he's like, I have thousands of letters from parents of potentially missing loved ones and parent letters from people who don't have their loved ones anymore because of this individual. So, like, absolutely fuck off. Interestingly enough, this was one of the longest trials in LA County history, Orange County history. It cost them like $10 million.
Yeah. Long trial and expensive trial.
Yeah. So, at some point, I'm sure actually immediately after, police were concerned with the 22 bodies they had yet to identify, especially since some scenes had a second set of footprints. They were very concerned that another killer was at large. This guy, Dennis McDougall, an author, thinks that he solved this in January of 2000. And he was like, didn't you guys remember the interview of this Bob Jackson who, like, totally confessed to murdering two hitchhikers with craft in Wyoming in 1957 and then murdering again in Colorado in 1976? And then he said he also joined in the murders in 1977. And then Jackson was like, during the interview, like, oh, well, duh, there's only like this many names on the scorecard list because, like, those are his most memorable kills, and he didn't write down the rest of them. But, like, the detectives looked into him and they were like, this guy needs help. So they got him into a mental hospital because they couldn't find anything or file any murder charges in Colorado or Wyoming. And they never identified those two missing victims that he said they had attacked in Colorado and Wyoming.
It does make you wonder how many accomplices went without being discovered.
Mm-hmm. Was there a different name that you had?
For what?
I thought you had said earlier that police thought his accomplice was this one specific guy, and then you would wait and
Graves, his ex, was the one they were most sure of.
Well, that would make the most sense, especially since he was, like, totally fine with him, like, picking up other dudes and shit. So, as it stands, Kraft is 77 years old, still on death row, at San Quentin. But those of you who have listened to me yell over and over and over again know that they are moving all of the death row inmates into the... My eye is twitching because I'm so angry. The life without parole inmate population. So according to the press conference on March 17th of this year, California's lovely governor, dearest Gavin fucking Newsom, stated he would really like to transform the state's oldest prison into a, and I quote, one-of-a-kind facility focused on improving public safety through the rehabilitation and education.
Of
terrible people.
It has to go somewhere. It can't just end there.
That's where the quote ends. It's Gavin Newsom. Nothing makes sense. Like... And I just want to know, like, how do you take, because they have at least 100 people on death row at San Quentin, right? And a lot of them are serial killers. So how do you justify, how are you planning to rehabilitate and educate people who have taken lives and in most cases for several years with no fucking problem? What's your education plan? What are you going to teach them? Most of them are, like, old as fuck, too. They don't give a shit.
Well, seems like a good time to mention that Kraft has always maintained his innocence.
Which is interesting because there was so much evidence that was found at his home and so much DNA evidence that linked him to so many victims.
Part of that psychosis, though.
Yeah, that's true.
Tragic, though, for so many reasons, but, you know, again, had him in 1975.
Mm-hmm.
And because of a bit of a police fuck-up and also just, like, a circumstance where they just didn't have enough to go on.
Yep.
Couldn't really do much.
Nope.
I will also say, not to go off topic, but to me, it's impossible to, like, consider this killer and not think differently of Dahmer.
Explain.
Dahmer was a copycat. There's nothing original about Jeffrey Dahmer.
Fair.
And I'm not saying that, like, Dahmer idolized this guy, but it just, the MOs are so similar that it's, like, kind of insane.
Yeah.
There are some similarities, I should say.
Yeah, that's true.
So, I guess in a weird sense, to me, it's like, I would be shocked if there wasn't some inspiration that Dahmer took from this guy. Because if you think especially about when the trial went down,
mm-hmm.
right, that's just a small handful of years before
mm-hmm.
Dahmer got going.
Mm-hmm.
Careful who you
idolize.
Choose your heroes as, yeah.
Yeah. So, there you have it, a long-winded episode. With lots of murder, mayhem, and horrific things. And, yeah. I also... I will be curious to see if they have to notify victims' family members if death row inmates are moved into a different part of San Quentin, or if they only legally have to notify people if they're being moved out of San Quentin into some of those other maximum security facilities.
I don't know how that works.
Well, that's what I'm saying.
I would imagine they don't have to say anything unless the status of that person's sentencing or whatever is being changed.
So I know for sure they have to legally inform if they are moving them to a different facility.
Seems weird.
I just don't know if they have to inform if it's moving. They're moving to a different facility, like within the same facility. Yeah, and they have to notify moving from one facility to another because, like, depending on if you're in Gen Pop or, like, Life Without Parole, like, that puts you into different contact with different people, and you could still be dangerous. So, there you have it, the scorecard killer. I think we are gonna maybe go eat a snack and watch something happier.
Drink more, because what else can you do?
I ran out of Bloody Mary mix.
There's always other things to drink.
That's true. So, don't forget to like, follow, interact with Instagram, talk to me. I don't know. I'm still noodling around the idea of doing that freeway killer episode because there's more than one. I will keep you in the loop. If you feel like there's something that you want to hear me talk about, please DM me on the Instagram. Otherwise, that's all I have for you today. Thank you for joining us, Dr. Manhattan, with your very busy schedule.
As always, anytime.
Oh, all right, we're going to go away now. I'm going to wake up the boys. Hey, what are you doing? Go outside. Yeah.